Welcome to Debug. I'm Renee Ritchie. Joining me as always is Guy English. How you doing, Guy?
Very good. Thanks.
Joining us today is Matt Drance, formerly of Apple, well known for his writing on Apple Outsider and also his own software development at Bookhouse. How are you, Matt?
Great. How are you guys?
Great.
I usually like to start off by asking people where they came from, the origin story, the issue zero. How did you get involved in software?
Well, I went to college. That had something to do with it. Going way back as a kid, my dad taught me Pascal when I was, 7 or 8 or so. He brought an IBM PS2 home. No, it was a PC Junior, I think, actually.
Oh, nice.
And then we got a PS2, and then we never got another computer. So I didn't really get into technology until I went to college, and quite a lot had changed by then. Like I didn't know that Macs had color until I went to college, because I hadn't really seen anything for a couple of years. So I got real heavy into programming while I was there, even though I wasn't a computer science major, and pretty much made the shift while I was in school, and then took the plunge. I'm from New York, and then moved out to California during the legendary internet bubble. Got a job with a startup. You know, they threw me in the deep end and then landed at Apple a couple of years after that. And now, what are we now? 12 years later, I'm here on my own.
So what kind of stuff are you doing with the startup? Like, client side or server side or what?
Yes. It was a startup called Calico Commerce, which no longer exists, like so many from that era. They were bought by PeopleSoft, which was then bought by Oracle. So I actually still have some former colleagues who are now like senior staff engineers at Oracle because they just stayed through all the acquisitions. So I give a shout out to my old Calico colleagues there. So it was, it was like a complex product configurator sort of thing. We did some work for Dell, you know, for computer config, and we did stuff for some car companies, but it was mostly JSP work. Java server pages for those who don't go that far back. I know JSP still exists, but not really. When we were starting, the JSP spec was still sort of, you know, in the larval stage. So actually, when I got there, we were still doing JHTML.
Wow.
Which was some, you know, fly-by-night spec that I think IBM and BEA made together. BEA made WebLogic, and I think BEA was also bought by Oracle.
Yes.
Now I'm starting to feel old, but
it would kind of generate stuff, right? Like you'd almost have a template kind of thing set up, and it would.
Right. So they both behave the same way. So JHTML and Java JSP were both, kind of like PHP, where you'd write a page, which was, you know, just sort of HTML interspersed with server side code, and then the application server would parse that and turn it into a Java servlet. So it would basically invert the whole thing. So what you would end up having when you built was a Java class that spit out HTML, even though you were kind of writing HTML that spit out Java. It was very wacky. But the JHTML thing was basically a pure HTML page, and there was this Java tag. And JSP looks more like PHP, where they have those little scriptlet things where you just inject the Java code in there.
Did you enjoy that? Or are you like, do you like server-side stuff at all, or what?
I did at the time, and it's funny because, you know, I was an Apple guy before I started at Calico, and, you know, Java, the state of Java on Apple was very bad before OS X. There was the Mac OS runtime for Java, or Mr. J, as he was affectionately known. So it was it was Windows Solaris shop there, and I pretty much didn't use a Mac aside from my house, but I didn't use a Mac professionally for more than 2 years. And so I started really getting into the server side stuff, even though I knew I loved end user, you know, design and interaction and stuff like that. And I actually sort of drank the Kool-Aid. You know, I had gotten to the point where I said, why are we making Java applets and Flash things and stuff like that? Why aren't we just doing web-based applications where the server does all the work? And this was especially in the late 90s when, you know, frankly, desktop machines weren't that powerful. Right. So there was a good argument to be made for that. But now we've got stuff in our pockets that, you know, can play 60 frames per second OpenGL. So it's a little less of a concern.
Right. That was like around the time where Sun was making a lot of noise about like a resurgence of thin clients, right? And with everything going on the back end.
The network is the computer.
Right.
And then they came around and they, I don't know if they ever actually shipped these, but they were talking about these Java chips.
Oh, yeah.
An inherent admission that they couldn't make Java fast enough. So it was like, we're going to make this hardware that makes Java run faster. And, you know, I worked with Java for many, many years, and I actually made more than enough excuses for it at the time, because I really believed it was the vision, the promise that it wanted to make was, I think, a good one. But as we've seen multiple times over since, it's right. a very, very hard promise to keep.
Yeah, it's a seductive proposition, but
yeah,
doesn't fit with reality that much.
Yeah.
What do you like about Java, if you still do?
Yeah, that's, to be fair, I have not really seriously looked at Java code in the better part of 6 years.
Yeah.
So my context is both rusty and probably out of date because, you know, the language itself has changed. I think it's a very good language to teach people object-oriented programming. Because it is brutally object oriented. Like, you know, you can't even declare a well, at least in my day, you couldn't even declare a constant without a class. So in terms of really hammering, and it helped me when I was learning OO, you know, I took my first OO class, it was in Java, and like it or not, I was going to understand what classes and objects were because you couldn't do anything without them. So, but as with all things, I think that purity, you know, has its limits, and they've backtracked quite a bit. You know, they're doing a lot of things that are similar to, you know, they have enums now, and they, you know, they have a lot of things that, you know, are sort of part of other languages that people have been demanding for years and years.
Go ahead. So yeah. my take on it was that they almost fetishized the object model a little early, and I like you, I haven't kept up with it, but yeah, that was my impression, is it that it went a little bit too far. What I did like about it was that it wasn't as crazy as C++, which is sort of bananas. And yeah, you're right. As an entry-level programming language, I think it's pretty good. My favorite actually was Pascal. I loved working in Pascal. And you said you started with that too, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I barely remember it. And you know, the last I saw Pascal code was probably when I read the Macintosh programming starter kit in college.
Yeah. You know, because they have like object-oriented Pascal and Delphi and stuff like that.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Which ended up being quite nice, actually. Like, I didn't do a lot of work on it. I made some internal tools while I was doing game development with it. And it was nice. It's just a nice language that's sort of been totally lost to the mists of time.
Yeah. I think it's great that you actually say that, Guy, because, you know, I've been in these sorts of conversations where, you know, somebody up and says, oh, I really liked Pascal. You know, I liked when we did Pascal at school, and everybody's kind of like, you know,
yeah.
But you know, let's see what's wrong with saying that, you know, it's just like every language, it's got its, you know, it's got pros and cons.
It's got quirks. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
It's like a little bit too verbose.
Yeah. Why can't you say you have fun using something?
Right. Yeah. Well, I try not to be a language bigot, although these days I'm very much, you know, I'm totally invested in Objective-C pretty much.
Yeah.
But I'm always kind of worried that I'm going to get blindsided by something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think a lot of people got blindsided by Objective-C when Apple really started knocking things out of the park.
Yeah.
I worry that maybe there's something out there that I haven't been paying attention to that's just going to sneak up on me and make me feel obsolete a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think what's interesting with Objective-C is, you know, it's not Objective-C that took off. It's the iPhone that took off, you know, and that was people know, and I can tell you this as having been an Apple evangelist for, you know, many years, you know, they go to a trade show or a developers conference. These guys did not want to hear about Objective-C. They did not want to hear about square brackets. They did not want to hear about anything that wasn't Java or C++. And the iPhone changed that just because the product was that successful. And it was such that people wanted to be part of the experience so badly that they didn't care what language it was in.
Right.
And that's a lesson for anybody who wants to build a platform, you know, is if the product comes first. And that's a daunting task, right? And, you know, it's not that's it's easy to say that, but doing that is, you know, who knows? I don't even think Apple knew that it was going to be this big. I think they knew it was this important.
Yeah, but whether or not it would actually do these kind of, like, have right. this kind of massive effect on things. So wait, there's a question for you. Yeah, focusing on the product and getting the nice product out the door is of paramount importance. How important is the tool chain being effective and support it in order to support the development of that product?
I think it's incredibly important. You know, if you can't trust the tools, then it ruins everything. And you know, we all make our Xcode jokes and stuff like that. And you know, Xcode has its limitations and whatever. But you know, I have no doubt, because I go back to Project Builder. You know, the tool has gotten leaps and bounds better every time. You know, modulo bugs happen, but it's a great tool. It's a great workflow. They have much more that they could and should do, but you know, more or less. And I know a lot of people, for example, are using App Code now to do iOS development, or at least, you know, to sort of augment their development. You know, I haven't gone that far. I trust the tools. I still think Instruments is the best developer tool anywhere. I mean, that more than my love for Apple products or technology or my history or anything like that, I don't think I would want to go to another platform if they didn't have a tool like Instruments.
Yeah, it's pretty mind-boggling how good it is. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's mind-boggling how badly we take it for granted. Not mind-boggling; it's perfectly understandable. But if you take that away, you know, you think about the sort of problems that you solve in 30 seconds with Instruments, so you could poke around for weeks and be nowhere.
Right. That's another one that all of the tools get maligned quite often by people who work with them day in, day out, because you only ever really notice the bugs or something, you know? Like if you do a long run in Instruments, you can use up a lot of memory.
Yeah.
Or maybe Shark used to give you some information that's really kind of a pain in the ass to find out in Instruments.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, being able to, like, the way that you can tie all the instruments together and really inspect exactly what's going on in the app is that it's, I don't know of any parallels on any other platform.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, like, you know, and I know a lot of people who do Cocoa development, Mac or iOS, but they don't use Xcode. You know, they use some editor of choice and they just use Xcode build, you know, on the, you know, they've got build scripts or whatever, and you know, they get by just fine with that, but they're not going to be using some command line tool to do performance analysis, you know? Well, that's not true. Actually, there was a Shark command line tool for a while. Right? It's probably still there. But you still need to read that and analyze it somehow.
Right.
The tool chain is incredibly important. And to that end, I mean, I don't just use Apple tools. I mean, I use, I'm a huge hockey fan. So I have to give hockey a plug. Hockey is, for those who don't know, it's over the air beta distribution. They also do crash reporting, and I believe they now do log submission. Depending on the logging library you use. They added that recently. I haven't looked into it yet. I need to. But it's an incredible tool. I mean, you know, I can, without naming names, I mean, you know, I've got a couple clients who, you know, who have various sized audiences, and, you know, every time, you know, this tool, and for those who listen to the show who aren't programmers, the tool that we're talking about is the library that you attach to your app. Surely you've seen this. When the app crashes, you launch it again, and there's a blue dialog that shows up that says, so-and-so crashed, quit unexpectedly. Would you like to send a report? And it says, send, don't send. Always hit the send button, please. Help us help you. But that's what we're talking about. So on the back end, you get these reports, and you know, you log into your dashboard. And I'm describing hockey right now, but all the tools, test flight, Crashlytics, criticism, you know, all of them.
It's a small family of them.
Similarly. Yeah. So you log in, you see your dashboard, and you just see all the crashes. And the good tools will find patterns, and they'll lump identical or even similar crashes together. And so you can just sort by number of crashes, and you can see in 5 seconds where your biggest problems are. And in a lot of cases, you know, there have been fewer than 5 bugs that have been responsible for like 90% of crashes, right, the crashes in a given app. And 3 of them you didn't even know existed. You know, like you look at it and you say, well, why is that happening? And then you say, holy cow. And you would never have found it yourself.
Because, yeah, that's something that you really sort of learn after having been in the game for a while, is that it's the dumb, weird little case that you just thought was like super simple,
mm-hmm,
that somehow managed to just jump in your face and bite you all the time.
Yeah.
Because it's often not this weird. Apps often have these weird, you know, race conditions and crazy things going on. But the one that shows up in the crash logs most often is just some like, oh, yeah, well, you know, you put a space for the password field and then something, 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 and
yeah, right,
it explodes, you know?
And just to add to that, I mean, someone who does beta test a lot of apps and writes about those apps, to have something like Test Flight or Hockey where the new version just shows up, and when you're using it, people do get that kind of feedback without you having to meticulously document everything,
right,
is incredibly helpful as well.
It's invaluable. And, you know, it's funny, just, you know, the whole, what you were saying, Guy, about edge cases and things, it's just probability math. You know, and you know, there's this longstanding thing, it goes back to people joking about, you know, Microsoft and Windows, and probably even further back than that. It's, you know, the idea of planned obsolescence and using customers as beta testers and stuff like that. Certainly nobody wants to do that. The truth is, though, you could have a test team of 100 people, which nobody does. Nobody has 100 testers. Even if you had 100 testers, even if you had 1,000 testers.
Even if you're NASA.
Yeah. There are 400 million iOS devices out there.
Right.
There's a bug out there that you haven't found, because there's a 1 in 400 million chance that somebody's going to hit it. Like, if there's a 1 in 400 million chance that this bug is going to get hit, it's going to get hit in the wild. Yeah. And if you only have 1,000 people in your building, you're not going to hit it.
There's no QA, like an active user base.
No, there really isn't. And, you know, it sounds like a cynical statement, but it's just the truth. And so, and if you create these tools that make it easier for people to let you know what's going on, that's a huge difference.
Yeah. Depressing developers with Matt Drance coming up next.
Empowering developers.
Oh, empowering, yeah. So one thing the point I want to make about that is it's hard to reproduce bugs in games. Because they're so timing sensitive, and it's a simulation, you know. When you had a good beta tester that could tell you exactly what specific steps to take and be able to reproduce it and give you great logs, or, you know, like a jot you down the story of exactly what happened to create that log, it is worth your weight in gold. A good tester is completely invaluable.
No doubt. Because
fixing the bugs often takes maybe like an hour or two. Finding them and being able to reproduce them takes forever.
Yeah.
And the better the better the tester, the more time I'm not spending. Like, if I don't have to spend 3 days trying to figure out how to reproduce a bug because a tester spent some time doing it, that's like a huge, huge net win for the project and for the product. And really always kind of bugged me that these guys weren't treated with more respect. Like, a lot of them are like young and they get paid by the hour, and they just kind of, they get, incentivized to file bugs rather than like by bug count, rather than by like the quality of the bugs. And it's kind of depressing. I think that's sort of a black area of software development where we don't pay enough attention to the great QA testers.
And sometimes in big companies, they get cut first and you end up having a really disproportionate number of developers to QA engineers.
Oh, every time.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely true. I think, you know, sort of echoing what I had said, before, if you don't have a good tester, then yeah, you're going to be passing that on to your users and to your staff. You know, you're going to ship bugs that shouldn't have been shipped. And so there's another thing at play here when we talk about that, when we talk about applying more resources later, the technical debt is what people like to call this. Although I guess technical debt is more of a conscious decision than an accident. I don't know. Maybe it's both. I don't know. It is what it is. Debt. Yeah, I guess the word debt is not necessarily intentional one way or the other. Anyway, the biggest thing, Evan Dahl, who I worked with at Apple, who now is at Flipboard, he co-founded Flipboard, He said this in a presentation. He said, you know, the key to making software is knowing which bugs to ship, kind of funny. I mean, it's the same thing as, you know, knowing which bugs to fix, but it's just a little funnier to put it that way. And it's really important. And that's not, people hear that and they think it's just an issue of prioritization about like, oh, well, that bug's not going to be that big a deal. We can fix that later. And obviously that's part of it, but there's also there's a nasty part of shipping, you know, having bugs in the wild where once it's in the hands of users, depending on the kind of bug, the fix may be much different now that real people are affected by it.
Right.
You know, if it's something that affects data, now you have to forever account for that old bad data and migrate away from it, as opposed to if it was some bug that you found during beta, you just say, oh, yeah, we fixed that, but you're going to have to uninstall your app now. You don't have that luxury once it's in the hands of thousands, millions of people.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. Like, one of the things I struggle with or I've had to spend a lot of time with over the years is sort of format compatibility.
Yeah, it's brutal.
It's a nightmare because it's you can't think of everything. You can't do it. So every decision that goes into what's going to be the canonical representation of your data has to be pretty well thought out. You can't just phone that in.
No. No. And you know, that goes to, you know, part of that is knowing where to be stubborn and where to be very conservative. You know, we, you know, we're design oriented people. We love making a splash and making change, you know, doing things that are visible, you know, that are sort of visibly radical, you know, at the UI level, at the user, you know, at the visual level is relatively easy. It's risky, but you know, doing, you know, it's not particularly dangerous. You know, I tend to be very open-minded when it comes to design and stuff like that, but when people want to make a change that affects data and data formats and stuff, I start to get very stingy, because you know, and I basically read the same riot act every time, which is, okay, so we've got all this old data out there, and if we want to do this, so there's a whole lot of not just work, but just general risk that we're going to incur in messing with people. And is this change worth that risk? You know, it's not just like moving a button to another side of the screen, which does have repercussions, but they're, you know, it's easily changed back.
Right. Well, I mean, there's one thing changing the texture in the back of a table view.
Right.
Or changing from like a core data to some kind of weird XML format. So how do you approach that? Like, so I'm fascinated by this sort of idea of conservatism in code bases, because I'm typically a pretty, like you said, I'm willing to experiment with a bunch of different stuff in code all the time, including dumbass hacks that I will say this is a stupid hack. I won't use it in shipping code, but I'm happy to mess with the Objective-C runtime or do some crazy stuff. But I'm pretty conservative when it comes to actually what I find is important.
Mm-hmm.
What areas of application development are you sort of more conservative and more liberal to, besides the UI and the data? Like,
yeah, so, I mean,
code structure, weird.
You know, that's hard because Objective-C is so, I think opinionated is the word Mike Lee used. It's a very opinionated language, and it's a very opinionated framework.
I think the frameworks are, and the culture is. I think the language you could do insane stuff with that has nothing to do with the way that we use Objective-C right now.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I feel like, and it's possible that it's just because I've spent the most time with it. I think probably Objective-C is the language that I've used for the longest period of time running. So that it might just be that, right, that's going to make me say this. But I feel like more than any other language I've used, and I've probably used 12 or so, I feel like Objective-C is the most prone to confusing, I wouldn't do it that way with, that's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like opinion is so strong for whatever reason with this language and this community, where people often get totally sidetracked on like, well, no, this works and it's sound and it's okay. It just doesn't look the way you would have written it, but right. That's, you know, and you know, there's a side conversation about readability and maintainability. I'm not talking about readability. Readability is always important.
Yeah.
But people get real pedantic about like, why didn't you put this over here? Why didn't you put this instead of that? I don't like those conversations. And especially as a consultant, as somebody who builds things for other people and often, you know, changes clients. I wouldn't say that frequently, but, you know, frequently enough. I have a pretty strict rule to, you know, not ruffle too many feathers. You know, like if they have a certain coding style, I try to conform to that, even if it turns my stomach, you know, and when I say turns my stomach, I mean, just personally, you know, if there's something that's an actual problem, like, so for example, prefixing classes, that to me is not a style thing. That's a stability danger thing. You know, namespace collisions are a real problem, and you know, it's not a style thing to do that. But regarding conservative and liberal, I like experimenting with UI. I think that, you guys had, you know, Renee, you got a podcast called Iterate, and you know, I think that that's important. You're never done refining an interface, and you need to be brave enough to experiment, not just hone. So, you know, I like shaking things up in that regard. I'm generally resistant to, my resistance to change is based on the schedule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have to ship at a certain time, then that changes the conversation as far as what can be done. If you don't care when we ship, but you want to do some really cool stuff, well, great. Then let's start screwing around. One thing that I do tactically as part of my workflow, you know, like you said, Guy, you know, you make a lot of changes that you would never ever ship, but you know, let's screw around. I think that back to the tool chain, you know, a good version control system is really important. I don't want to, you know, it's like a language war. I don't really want to get into it, but you know, I usually use Git, and certainly more than its predecessors, Git makes branching and merging so much easier than it had been. You know, CVS and SVN, I used to be really scared to branch something. And now if you're working on a new feature, or you're just screwing around, like you said, you know, there's no reason to not do it in the branch. I mean, in my opinion, it works that well. But if I'm working on something so experimental and so, sort of out of the box, so to speak, I'll just create a new project. Like for all of my client work, you know, I've got the repo, I've got, you know, documents or whatever, and I have a folder called experiments, and it's just dozens of Xcode projects that are just this little thing all by itself. Because how do I know it's even going to make sense, or that it's going to work, or that my first run of writing the code is going to be not crap? And why would I ever pollute the actual source, the actual product source tree with that? So I do try very hard to justify every change at every level, and my stinginess, like I said, increases as the deadline looms nearer.
We used to use ClearCase at my old enterprise job, and it was a nightmare.
I remember ClearCase.
I had to have a dedicated ClearCase guy just to make sure the insanity didn't stop.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I wouldn't say most, but a lot of companies, once you get to a certain size, whether it be number of people or amount of code, you know, they do have sort of a dedicated SCM person, because, you know, you need to manage these things. I mean, Apple's got a whole, you know, got a whole build organization. And you know, most people, even some programmers, say, well, how hard is it to build something? It's really freaking hard to build something once you're dealing with, you know, projects that big.
Yeah. That's one of the things I hate messing with the most. Like when I have to mess with project settings.
Yeah.
It kills me. It's like, and I understand it, but I don't want to have to think about that. I've got something to build that I want to be thinking of, like not messing with the various settings. Yeah.
Totally. And, you know, like we were saying about testers, I mean, a good build engineer is incredibly valuable. I mean, I have a good friend who's been a build engineer for probably the better part of 20 years. And, you know, he's seen everything. He doesn't specialize in one thing. You know, he's using Perforce, and, you know, CVS before that, and ClearCase, like you said, Renee. Did you guys have was this on Windows?
It was a database company. So they had, almost every flavor of operating system that it had to be built for.
Okay. So on Windows, and I don't know if Rational did this for Linux or anywhere else, I feel like they were going to bring it to Mac, but maybe they didn't. So they actually had Windows Explorer integration, like on the desktop. Like you could navigate the files on the desktop and just right click and do like check in, check out and all that other stuff. Mm-hmm. And at the time when I was a junior programmer, just sort of starting off, I thought it was the greatest thing in the world because it was very hard for me to visualize this abstract source tree and all these other concepts. But now I find it terrifying, you know, because you could totally just not realize what folder you're in. And, you know, like I know when I'm in Git, I know when I'm doing stuff with branches and stuff, you know, whether I'm using the GitHub app or using Xcode or using Terminal, I know when I'm screwing around with sort, you know, repository source code. But that, like the Finder integration stuff where your repository folder looks exactly like your desktop folder is, that's a little scary.
And that poor guy, I mean, we talk a lot about how developers and even QA guys lose sleep, but the build guy, especially if there was a problem or a bug that needed to be fixed for really important customers, that guy did not get to leave, ever.
Yeah. Or he had to come in at some odd time. You know, that's the luxury of having a large company is hopefully that's not just one guy, you know?
Right.
You know, but yeah, when it's a small company and you're the only one who knows anything about that, you know, most competent engineers know their way around a VCS, but it's that one moment where you have no idea what happened. Like you issue a command and just you get an error and you're like, okay. And then you look and all your files are hosed or they're, you know, a month old. You gotta call somebody. There's no two ways about it. So yeah, and you know, every role is critical. And, you know, you wonder, you know, there are all different apps out there. There are apps that look great and just don't, you know, there's just something not right about it. You can't put a finger on it or it's, you know, where it's crashing on you. And, you know, like it works so great, except in this one area, you know, all that stuff is just a sign of a piece missing.
Right.
And I think people constantly underestimate just, you know, how much goes into this stuff.
Well, I think the first time I was really sort of introduced to a lot of that sort of support, technical support stuff internally inside a company was at Ubisoft. And yeah, just having like a build guy let us know how to set up all the, you know, the Perforce and this and that. And like when you'd make a build, you'd get an email saying if it succeeded or failed. And if it failed, everybody would be mad at you. That was great. It was eye opening. You and I do similar things right now in that we both do mostly consulting. Do you miss having a large support staff? Like, do your clients have that kind of stuff? Do you find it hard to integrate with that? Or,
well, sure. I mean, yeah, I miss having more resource. And you know that was a big. I've been gone. It's been more than 3.5 years now that I've been gone from Apple. So I'm over it now. But yeah, I mean, the first 6 months or so being out here without those kind of resources available, yeah, it was brutal. And, you know, I had a taste of it because I worked in developer relations. So I got to see how people worked and talk to them about it, you know, after hours, people like you, Guy. And so I had a feel, but, you know, it's not until you're there doing it all by yourself and you don't have $100 billion worth of backing on you.
Yeah, when you're setting up Jenkins and it's not working and you're kind of...
Right.
You know, pissed off. Yeah.
Right. No, I don't. So yeah, I guess I miss it, obviously, in the sense that I would love to have it, but it's not a sore point for me anymore because I've adapted to life without it.
Right. But so to me, that's made me realize just how much value it actually does have. Like having to do everything myself or actually, for me, my partner Chris Parrish does a lot of, like, he set up Jenkins and did all like the hard stuff. I phone it in and write a lot of code. But yeah, like, so that's really made me realize just how much value there is in sort of the unsung portion of software development. Are we missing anybody?
You
we got the build, the build
roles, people.
Yeah, yeah. While we're iterating, this is not what we plan to talk about at all, but while we're listing off sort of unsung heroes of development, any other departments you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, people like to, you know, joke about management and meetings and stuff like that. But, you know, I think that a good
project manager, PM?
Yeah, a good project manager, which is not to be confused with a product manager. You need those too, but at least on the engineering side, like a project manager, somebody who keeps things on track, is really important. I don't think it's always important, but depending on the size of the project and depending on the personalities involved, you just need to have somebody who's there and says, you know, reminds people what the focus is, you know, extracts dates from people, even as painful as it might be, as inaccurate as they might be. Because all that stuff is just data. So, you know, if you have a pesky engineering engineering project manager, EPM, as we'd call them at Apple, you know, it was like, when do you think it'll be done? When you're like, I don't know. But you spit out a date and you very quickly realize if that date was accurate or not. And
so that's a pet peeve of mine, is being told, just come up with a date.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the times it's like, well, I need to investigate whether this is actually possible to implement without breaking all of the backwards binary compatibility and all of that sort of mumbo jumbo. When I'm told, well, just come up with a date, just guess. I'm like, well, that's not going to, it just seems like it's going to screw up your plan.
I should probably, yeah, let me step back a bit and clarify, because, you know, when I say just give me a date, that assumes that we already at least know what we're doing. I mean, if we're sort of in an early stage and it's like, I think this is a good idea, when do you think it'll be done? There's at least one other conversation that needs to happen at that point, which is like you said, well, I need to find out if this is even possible or feasible.
Right. It's like step one, the first task is I'm going to spend a week investigating this.
Exactly.
After that, I'll get back to you with a date.
Yeah. Right. And that's totally, that in my opinion is a totally valid response. But, you know, especially if you're at a company or whatever that, you know, if you've been prototyping and iterating for a long period of time, that mentality is sort of infectious. And when it gets time to actually ship something, you might have forgotten how to be rigid, you know, and be, right, you know, focused and to some extent brutal in terms of triaging and prioritizing.
I've had this same experience with good project managers, because games is like, well, it's like kind of artsy-fartsy too, right? So,
right.
There's always like this iterative thing, and people always want to change it a lot more than is maybe necessary for the product. So you made a distinction between product managers and or EPMs and project managers.
Yeah, the product manager is, you know, that's where we sort of blend into, you know, marketing, you know, like, you know, the person at a high level, you know, and a, you know, somewhat non-technical level, you know, of what the product should do.
Actually, that's interesting. Who do they report to in a theoretical generalized structure? I don't mean specifically at Apple or anybody else. Do you see the product managers being part of the marketing or is part of the development side of things?
So this is something that Apple gets right, is that, you know, the outbound marketing, you know, meaning like the people who come up with the ads and the catchphrases and stuff like that, is not necessarily the same person as the people who are doing the product, you know, management, product marketing, so to speak. Yes, those people obviously are thinking about addressable markets and what customers want and stuff like that. But I think this is something I'm meaning to write about on Apple Outsider, is I think this is, especially in technology, this is something that people really get wrong, is the both perceptually and organizationally, the intermingling of sales and marketing, I think is a huge mistake, because it's just, I don't even need to meet anybody at the company. I immediately know now that sales are an inherent driver of the product process, which is very bad. And obviously you need to sell things. I'm not saying, you know, pay no attention to your customers and stuff like that. But the idea that you should embark on some 6 to 9 month journey just because a sales trend told you to, those sales trends could totally change in 6 to 9 months. You know, you need to do what makes sense for your company's vision and your, you know, the evolution of your product. And if you do that right, the sales should follow. A good product should always be easy to sell.
My last job before iMore was product marketing. And it basically, at the end of the day, it turned into me being a human interface between development and outbound marketing and sales.
Yeah, that's brutal.
It's all a translation service, because they speak completely different languages and have totally different expectations.
Right. And, you know, the salespeople, I'm not knocking salespeople when I say this. I'm just saying that it's not part of the product process. You know, the salespeople are focused on selling. and they're good, and just like a tester, like a, you know, a good salesperson, you know, has an understanding, is able to separate what they need to sell versus what the company needs to, you know, go on some other vision. And, you know, even somebody who's good at selling may not have that perspective. They're just going to keep coming back with, I lost a deal because we didn't have this, or if we had this, I know I could sell X more, which, you know, which is always a false statement. You never know how much more of something you can sell.
And an incredible time sink if you have an undisciplined company.
You can see why that would be a common pitfall, right? Because obviously the salespeople are the ones getting the direct feedback.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and as an evangelist, you know, I was more or less a frameworks salesman, you know, I was trying to, you know,
it's a good way to think about it.
Yeah. You know, I don't want to say that, but I'm, you know, I was trying to convince people to use a specific kind of technology, and it got easier and easier over the years as Apple became more popular. But, you know, a lot of it was, you know, when I was trying to tell people to use Java on the Mac or to use Objective-C back in the early aughts, it was a joke. It was a lot of no's. And, you know, so I would get, you know, obviously I had a lot of frontline sort of feedback about, like, this is why they're not coming over. This is what's missing. This is what sucks. You know, a good organization can, you know, everybody talks, and they all figure out, you know, what the sort of intersection is, you know, the Venn diagram or whatever you want to do. And they use that to move forward. But any situation where a single stakeholder, whether it be sales or outbound marketing or even engineering, you know, like a purely engineering driven organization, I don't think that works either.
No, I'm pretty sure it doesn't work.
Well, at least when we're talking about consumer products, if what you're selling is a technology, then maybe, you know, being purely engineering driven does make sense.
Really? I don't know.
I said maybe. I don't have much experience in that sort of realm.
So I would see the APIs or the support that you would offer as being the product as much as the actual code. You know what I mean? Like if I license you a 3D engine,
sure,
and it's got great tools, then that's the product. You know, like that's the
Yeah, and I, you know, I feel like, and you know, I should know better when I say that, and it's a really good point, because, you know, you would hope that because the people doing that are engineers, then they, you know, that they sort of know what, you know, how to use what they're doing, but I've certainly seen the opposite. You know, that was another big part of my role at Apple, was when, you know, when we update or make new frameworks, you know, there would be feedback from me about, you know, well, I don't think people are going to want to use this way. I think that this is what they're going to want. And, you know, some of it is very minor and semantic, but it makes all the difference, you know, when it's one call instead of two.
Can you sort of explain that, sort of the pipeline? Like you talk to developers and then sort of synthesize the complaints and then send it off to the product guys, right?
Yeah. And I used the term salesman before, but yeah, it really was kind of a double agent sort of role.
Yeah, I think that's unfair to yourself and what the evangelists do. But the best way for people to sort of communicate to Apple about the tool chain is to, well, first, file radars, right?
Yeah.
And second, talk to evangelists.
It's easy to say that. You know, you may or may not have access to people at Apple, so that's really important. I mean, the one thing I would say is if you do have that access, if you do have somebody's email address or whatever, absolutely use that with care.
Oh, yeah.
Don't just, and I know you know that guy, but, you know, this is just for those listening at home. Know who you're emailing. You know, if you have the email address of somebody who manages Passbook, don't flame them about mail. You know, for example, these things seem like no-brainers, but they're, you know, it's, you know, one of those things where you're having a bad day or whatever, and you have these tools available to you, and you have this hammer, and you can throw it through the window. You could not throw it through the window. And it's usually a split second decision. So, you know, use these tools wisely. You, like you said, log a bug. And I know that that's, you know, the radar process is very opaque from the outside. And so, you know, that's tough, but
yeah. And radar web is basically broken. But
it's,
whatever, it's still, it's the best best tool to do. Yeah, and I'm really not advocating just randomly spamming anybody at Apple.
Certainly, it never hurts to know people at the company you're depending on, you know? Yeah. I think that's a true statement no matter what.
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, especially getting in touch with the evangelist for the portion of the problem that you have an issue with. Like if you're doing graphics, get in touch with somebody specific, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Can probably help.
And along lines of a picture being worth a thousand words, I mean, if you do have access to somebody, whether it be via email or just at a conference, if you run into them at a conference, you can show them what you're doing.
Yeah, it's invaluable. The WWC labs are incredibly useful.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just in terms of being able to solve the problem or give them proper context. You know, for them to see it, assuming what you're doing is cool and whatever, and then for them to see what's standing in the way of this thing being even greater, that's compelling. And I said this when I spoke at C4, the last C4.
That's a good talk.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. But you never know what Apple's doing. I mean, that's a fact. You never know what they're doing. You never know what they're thinking or how far out they're thinking. And for all you know, the thing you're working on could be exactly what they're looking for to feature in the next keynote event or commercial or whatever. So for you to keep them apprised on what you're doing, and again, provide that context of what would be possible if only this bug were fixed or this feature existed, that's real data that I can assure you is used, you know, when prioritizing these things.
One thing I noticed is that people kind of yell at Apple people on Twitter and stuff when there's problems with the tools or there's some bullshit about the, like something happening on the App Store. I can sort of understand it, but it's not constructive. Nobody you're going to be yelling at in public has much control over any of that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just random sort of venting, and it's, you know, I haven't had to be on the other side of that, but that's got to be a little bit grating. And you kind of spearheaded that for most of your time at Apple, right?
You take a lot of tomatoes.
Yeah. How do you handle that? Is without getting a thick skin or just getting pissed off at everybody?
I don't think you can handle it without getting a thick skin. And you know, and again, you know, like I'll be the first. I mean, I'm as guilty of this as anybody. And you know, there's just it's like I said, throwing the hammer through the wall. Sometimes you got to just step away from the internet.
Yes.
And it's very easy to quit your Twitter app for 10 minutes.
Yeah, like maybe rage quit your Twitter rather than throwing a hammer at somebody.
You know, people think about that evangelism role as being very prestigious and whatever. There's a lot of poop to shuffle. And, you know, a lot of, like you just said, like just people you've never heard of ragging on what's now your stuff, you know, that you take a lot of pride in. And you know, if you come to Apple from an outside world where you used to do that and then you do, it's very quick. Like as soon as you're wearing that badge and it becomes, you know, it becomes an attack on you. You feel it immediately. And it's just, you know, it's just standard, like do unto others, you know, like you don't have to get a job at Apple to realize that somebody's on the other end of that and they're right.
Actual people.
Yeah. You gotta, you know, you have to separate it at some point. You know, it's just good customer service to know that at the core, somebody's hurting because of something and how can you help them solve that problem, because that will make them feel better and it will stop them from complaining, which will make you feel better. Yeah. So, you know, there is a mutually beneficial solution.
Yeah. There's a way that everybody can win.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of outside Apple, get the segue. Apple Outsider.
Mm.
It appears that you took a conscious choice not to talk about anything technical, despite being a pretty technical guy. Is there a reason for that, or did you just sort of want to talk about the company? Or did you not want to get into anything specific, or maybe avoid what you had been doing as a technical representative in a way?
Yeah, I mean, it is a conscious decision, but that site to me is about strategy and PR and just, you know, the soft side of product development. And so really it's a focus thing. It's certainly not that I'm shy or anxious about speaking technically since I'm here right now. And you know, I did that here's the shameless plug. I did that book for Pragmatic a couple of years ago, iOS Recipes.
Oh, yeah. I forgot to pimp that. I'm sorry. That's a good book.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a little long in the tooth now. I mean, it was written for iOS 4, and most of the stuff in there is fairly evergreen. You know, it wasn't too badly obsoleted by later iOS releases.
That's one of the things I liked about it. It wasn't like a clever, weird, it wasn't like a set of clever little hacks that you could do with the APIs. It was more like here's a structure to build X, you know?
Thank you.
Yeah. Like it did. It had legs, you know?
Yeah. No, that's what I was going for. It's funny, you know, the Bookhouse website, I built that by hand in, you know, July and August of 2009, and I haven't touched it since. I updated the copyright. You know, when I was originally designing and planning that site, you know, there was going to be a blog section, but just never happened. You know, I think it would be cool if, you know, these things probably exist, but I feel like I'd love to collaborate with somebody on a technical blog.
Really?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Just throwing it out there.
In sort of like the recipes kind of style or what?
Honestly, I feel like some of the things that we're taught, you know, like both, you know, code and just, you know, realism of product engineering, like some of the stuff we've been saying for the last hour, you know, I think there's a lot of stuff, especially, you know, there's all kinds of developers out there and it just is based on what kind of situation they've been thrown in. You know, there are people who are really, really good coders and they just, for whatever reason, haven't been empowered or brought to the table or whatever you want to say, as far as making product decisions or having some kind of stake. You know, like you were saying, Guy, you know, about, I can't give you a date on this. I need a week to investigate. You know, there are people who just don't have the authority to say something like that. And they could be really, really good programmers and really good developers. And they could get to this next level if only they had an opportunity to whatever. You know, I feel like there are non-code things that you could say to people that would make them better engineers. And then similarly, there are people who are technically minded, but not necessarily knee deep in code all day, who could read something and learn from it very well. It's, you know, there's all this. It's a big spectrum of, you know, the people who do what we do.
Yeah, I read, you know, Ranzan reports like Michael Lopp, and I take a lot of what he has to say, which kind of covers a little bit of that. Then there's some technical stuff. Yeah, I think that is a good idea for a blog. And we should talk. Apple Outsider does what for you? It just scratches your itch. You're like, you have something you want to say or something's bugging you about the coverage, you know?
The truth is that I don't write nearly as often as I would like to or as I should. But, you know,
I really like that it's very... it's very irregular, and it's only when you actually have something really smart to say.
Well, I always want it to be that. Yeah. So I'm glad you like that. Thank you. The truth is I have something to say more often than once every 2-3 months. It's just, you know, between my day job and the two kids, it's a little harrowing. You know, so lately it's just, is something shocking or angering enough? So like the last two entries were the PS4 thing. And then the one before that was when Forstall was knocked out, which was, you know, that was an earthquake type situation. So, you know, and the other thing is I don't want to just, you know, it's not my profession. You know, it's not a moneymaker for me. So, you know, I don't have any ads. I don't care about page hits. I don't, you know, I don't need a readership. I don't need a readership. I mean, I value the people who do read it and appreciate it. And I feel like the best way to serve those people who aren't paying me, although if they bought a shirt, they are, you know, the best way to serve them is to not waste their time.
Right.
Because, you know, there are sites like iMore and Daring Fireball and Next Web that sort of give you the latest sort of stuff, you know, and that's not, I don't want to do that. I don't want to chime in on everything. You know, for me, it's just, you know, do I have time and do I have something to say that maybe other people are missing out on?
Yeah, I like that approach. I think that's respectful for the audience, and you're not spamming people. You're not doing a link blog with like little snarky comments and stuff.
No, right.
That sounds like I'm making fun of like John, but
or, yeah, and,
yeah,
and
I'm really not. But
I'm not making fun of John. I'm not making fun of Renee either. You know, yeah, I'm just saying that's you know it's
the markets are all being served in great different ways, and I think you've picked a very interesting sort of niche to fill.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and that's the thing. I don't want to. I love writing, and I would love to do it more, but it's not where we are right now.
Right.
Your piece on regime change, though, I think for me was one of the seminal ones at that moment, because you had you had been at Apple, but you weren't there anymore, and you had the benefit of perspective on it. And I think you managed to distill all that down into a very lucid, very clear take on the situation.
Thanks. And you know, really, that was sort of like a therapy session where like most of that was just like, I can't, just sort of saying out loud, I can't believe this is happening. And you know, we still don't know really what happened. Right. You know, there are things here and there, and we can, you know, connect dots, but we don't really know what happened there.
Well, the fallout is still going on.
So. Totally. So, I mean, you gotta go way back for the last time things got shaken up like that at Apple.
It was even bigger perhaps in the context that Tim Cook had only taken over a year previously. So the entire top end of Apple looked very different at the end of that than it did just a year previously.
Right. And that was that tagline, regime change, was something of a personality test. People probably think it's referring to Forstall leaving. I was talking about Tim Cook being in charge.
It was the first time we might have gotten a glimpse of Tim Cook's Apple, which was because he's a different person than Steve Jobs, will inevitably end up being a very different Apple.
Exactly. Well, and I shouldn't say that's what I was talking about. It was deliberately vague. You know, like I said, it was a personality test. But, you know, that headline had multiple meanings. So, you know, as much as I liked writing that piece, and as much as I liked the attention it got, I hope I don't have to write it for a while, because it was pretty stressful.
It was stressful just writing it?
No, I just mean like the palpitations.
The tectonic shift.
Happening.
Yeah,
it can only take so much excitement.
Yeah, so I remember you telling me shortly after you left Apple that you were like shy to talk about it because, you know, you sort of had the culture of the omerta sort of thing. You feel a little bit more relaxed now? Or what?
Oh, well, of course. I mean, you know.
It's been 3 years, right? So.
Right. You know, my first post to Apple Outsider was probably 10 months after I left. It was a while.
Yeah.
And there were a bunch of things that I had written a lot of drafts, and I wasn't ready to push the button. I wasn't ready, you know, to get out there yet, just because, you know, Apple's very controlled in its communications. And I was a little worried about, well, so there was just the psychology of that, which, you know, having been there for 8 years, you know, you have to get over it. And then similarly, you know, I didn't want to do it too soon because I was, to some extent, a public face of the company. And I didn't want there to be a lot of confusion about whether or not I was still there.
Yeah. Like the Pope come Thursday.
Yeah, right.
How much should a regular iOS developer, not maybe regular, but someone who's just, they work on iOS, they work on software, how much does a regime change affect them short term as opposed to long term?
Short term, very little. Developer relations is, you know, is still the organization it always was. And I don't think, and this is pure speculation. I don't have inside information on this. I need to be very clear about that. We already saw, you know, Steve left 18 months ago. He died 16 months ago. And we could talk about what changed and, you know, but, you know, I think we see quite plainly what hasn't changed. You know, people just went back to work because that's what you do at Apple. And if they could weather that, then I'm not particularly worried about this shuffle. You know, Scott's people are now under Craig, but you know, I doubt much below that level has changed too much.
So I'm anticipating that iOS 7 won't be as radical as some people think it's going to be. And that's without any sort of internal knowledge. Like, I think some people are expecting Johnny Ive to come in and just
sandblast it.
Yeah. And I don't think that's a realistic goal given the way scheduling works. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I do. I think Johnny's influence will be seen.
Sure. Yeah.
I agree that it's not going to be a repl-. Although, I mean, I got to tell you, man, they've the company's so much bigger than when I was there that, you know, they have resources now that they didn't have before. And, you know, for all I know, I mean, I remember being really surprised at WWDC when they started talking about iOS 5.
Right.
At least from a technology perspective, maybe not at end user features, but certainly as a developer.
Yeah, there's a lot of changes in that.
Yeah, like, wow, you guys have been busy. And Renee, was it you? Were you the one who talked about this, about how there's, you know, Apple's falling into this sort of every other release cycle where one is refinement and the other one is, you know, a whole bunch of radical changes?
I have mentioned it, but I'm not the only one. The TikTok thing, I think, is becoming more and more industry standard.
Yeah. And so what are we on right now then? So what should iOS 7 be by that pattern?
Well, that's interesting, because I was actually going to ask your take on this, because a lot of people just looked at iOS 6 from a feature standpoint. You know, you swap one maps for another, you get Passbook, Facebook is integrated, and from an end user point of view, it doesn't look as big or as audacious as iOS 4 when you get multitasking, or 5 when you get iCloud and all these other things. But from a developer perspective, is it more evenly spread out? Do you get a more steady flow of API than maybe we get end user features?
I would say at a top level, and, you know, Guy, you can answer this question too. I would say at a top level, yes, there's always tons of new developer stuff. And it really just becomes an issue of what are you doing and how applicable is it to not just your skill set, but the actual problem you need to solve in the next 6 months.
And yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. Is
total crapshoot.
Yeah. Like the Passbook APIs, that's awesome. Not a lot of people have a lot of use for it. Newsstand APIs. I've never worked with them. I don't know if Matt has, but it enables Marco to go do the magazine, which is, you know, big new business for him. Mm-hmm. So it really just kind of depends what you're looking at, you know, what feature set your application requires.
But I mean, I've been very, you know, I sort of alluded to it earlier. I mean, I've been very enthusiastic, you know, as somebody who used to be an advocate for developer technologies at Apple. I've been really impressed and surprised by sort of the stuff that they've managed to give to us the last couple of years. I mean, I think I said this on Twitter recently. There are some things that I've done for clients in the last, you know, 6 months that just straight up would not be possible without iOS 6.
Right.
And you know, other things which would have been possible, but brutally difficult, like months of R&D difficult. And, you know, that's a good framework where the vendor does that R&D for you so that you never have to.
Yeah, I do love that. I mean, we did, when we shipped Napkin recently, we went 10.8 only.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise doing stuff like the document picker for iCloud documents would have been huge, and like, right, you know, in 10.8, it's built right into the file open dialog.
Right.
It's just so much stuff that we'd had spec'd out and had started to implement that we could just toss, because relying on the platform vendors almost always a win.
Yep. Yep. And, the flip side of that is you have, especially with a company like Apple that does not hesitate to change things. Right. You have to listen to the vendor. If this is a big, big deal, you know, when Apple says, oh, maybe you shouldn't use that, or, you know, even more forcefully, don't use that, you better listen. Like, as soon as you hear something like that from Apple, you should assume that it's going to be gone soon.
Yeah, I think there's an attitude thing for that. There's either the attitude of, well, they're supplying my platform, therefore it is incumbent upon them to keep everything working and stable. That I rely on.
Yeah, not this
platform. That's not my attitude at all. Because my attitude is basically, I'm there to make Apple money, and I get some of that. I get money by making them money.
Yeah.
Which I think some people, that kind of turns their stomach a little bit, but I think it's a better way to look at it in terms of, you know, I'm running a business, right?
Yeah.
So following along with Apple, like helping them ends up with them helping you a lot.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, just the point that you made about somebody assuming, you know, a lot of other people do this. You know, the enterprise companies do this.
Yep.
You know, they keep it alive forever. And that stuff stands in the way of progress. You know, like every, you know, you got a staff of 20 people making sure that this new version runs on code that some other guy wrote 10 years ago.
Yeah.
What could those 10 people be doing right now?
Right. I think Microsoft did a great job on that, and it kind of drove them into the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. No, legacy stuff is deadly. And, you know, like everybody, you know, this, you know, it's just people dust off the why won't Apple go after the enterprise article, although they kind of are now. But I don't know how aggressively they actually are. I feel like
they're like infiltrating, not attacking.
Yeah. But certainly on the Mac side, I mean, that was the answer. And it was the answer that for whatever reason, you know, the executives never really got into it. Steve would never really directly answer this question. And I think maybe he was just sick of answering it. But I mean, that was the gist of it. Is, you know, he would say it's not in our DNA. And basically, I think that was what he would say. Like, the, you know, enterprise is not part of our DNA. And what he meant was, these people want us to make the same crap for 20 years. And we're not going to do that. I mean, that's really what it came down to.
Which is interesting, because now the bring your own device trend is effectively having people bring their devices to enterprise instead of enterprise adopting it. And as much as you hear, you know, sometimes people say Apple has disinterest in gaming, the platform they created has become such a rich pool for game developers that it almost doesn't matter how aggressive Apple is personally in evangelizing those things.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, the history of Apple and game companies is an interesting one. And yeah, I mean, Apple largely holds the cards right now. I mean, you know, yeah.
Which is shocking. I mean, we've both followed Apple for a long time. The fact that they're holding the cards in gaming is just ridiculous.
It is. It's, yeah. I mean, it's great. It's wild. And that really was, I don't want to say it was circumstantial. You know, like, I don't think iOS was developed with gaming in mind.
No, I think they fell backwards into success.
Yeah. It was happenstantial.
And you know, I remember when we were briefing people very early on the SDK, you know, I wasn't that much of a gamer. I mean, most of the gaming I did was sort of, you know, computer games, not even console games. And so, but, you know, a bunch of people gave feedback and they said, this is going to be a killer gaming platform.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, really? Like 3-inch screen? Like, yeah, the accelerometer is cool, but... And I just wasn't thinking, I was thinking of the same games on that device. I wasn't thinking of new games.
Yeah. I guess the PSP had been around for a little bit around there, a couple of years.
Yeah, PSP, Game Boy, you know.
Yeah. And it had been kind of obvious that these things could go somewhere. But the way that Apple just said, like, well, they didn't intentionally do it, but they basically stripped everything away and gave like a multi-touch screen. And the thing with games is that, you write your games to fit the hardware, and you design the games to fit the hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So it really, like, the multi-touch opened up a huge, huge swath of new land to sort of be cultivated in terms of game design. Unfortunately, we've got quite a lot of clones, and it's not super awesome. But in terms of market share, it's doing really great, and there's a lot of really interesting titles out there anyway. I'm going to be interested to see what they have to do. And the other thing, and this goes back to sort of supporting legacy stuff, because Apple makes you use OpenGL and OpenAL, and you can only write to the APIs, mm-hmm. The games are far more portable and far more future-proof than they are on the consoles. Because in console land, we would code for the specific chip.
Yeah.
And it would be like the timing of like the GPU and like... You know, you fiddle with this bit over here and you do this with the DMA over there just to get like to get the best performance out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Apple forcing people to write to the APIs is making these games better and more future-proof. And I think that is a huge boon for them as they sort of, because they'll be able to move all of this stuff forward.
Yeah. And, you know, you bring that up and it sort of makes me wonder what Sony was trying to say with that announcement they had. They talked about a supercharged PC architecture. And it's like, really, you're building a PC? That's what you want us to hear?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Maybe
7 years after,
maybe that's what they were trying to say, that, you know, this is going to be a more industry standard sort of thing, and it's going to be easier for you to develop for it. But I didn't, I wish I could see that. I wish I had access to the video, because I didn't hear every word that they said.
Yeah.
But in terms of what was paraphrased in the press and what the slides said, you know, I didn't. Well, you're a game developer. I mean, did you hear anything there that made you think that this was going to be any different from what you just described?
No, I felt that they were going to basically package up a PC
and still make you do all kinds of crazy bit twiddling and stuff like that.
I didn't see anything about APIs. So the PS2 is crazy program for that. PS3 got a little bit better. The PSP was on paper. Like, so I did the bring up for an Unreal Engine based game on the PSP when we just had dev kits. And the documentation read awesome. Like, it was like nice, clean APIs. It just didn't, nothing worked. Like, it didn't work as documented, even a little bit. Like, people make, or, you know, people can crack a couple of jokes about Apple documentation, which these days is really, really good. But, you know, back in 2001 was a little bit spotty. But holy cow, like, this, you know, these PSP docs just flat out lied to you. So I don't think they've got the software act together. Well, because I don't know if it's peculiar. I think they wrote the docs as in, this is how we're going to implement it, and then the implementation just totally didn't work the right way.
Right. That was going to be my question. Do you think that this was some kind of miscommunication once they wrote the docs, or do you think they wrote the docs first?
100%. I think it was a miscommunication with the way. I think they wrote the docs in terms of, like, this is how we want everything to work. And then they'll do stuff like, well, because of the, you know, they're building the product, so they change out the audio chip.
Mm-hmm.
And now, so that channel doesn't behave quite the same way as it did according to the docs.
Right. So you're saying they basically published their own early stage spec without editing it.
Yes. Yes.
That's interesting.
And yeah.
To my knowledge, you know, Apple's developer documentation is not built that way. I mean, it's not an issue before or after, but, you know, that developer documentation is written for developers,
yes.
You know, as opposed to being a white paper or something.
Yeah, it was really spotty and kind of weirdly done. And, like, late in the development cycle, they changed out the screen to be crappier, like, just before we shipped. They took a megabyte of memory right at the end. Oh, and they downclocked the device. That was it. The three things that happened in, like, the last month where they, like, they changed it from being 333 megahertz down to 222.
Weird.
Weird? That's a lot. That's a lot of weekends spent trying to get those cycles.
Well, no, it's awful. It's brutal. But, you know, so from my perspective, I'm just sort of thinking about, like, why did that happen? I mean, was that an issue of developed everything in isolation and then just put the parts together way too late and then realized that the thing was overheating or running out of battery or something? Or,
like, it was running out of battery because battery life was awful. So they changed out the screen to be less bright and kind of crappy, and they downclocked it. And they took an extra megabyte of RAM for that front end PSP, like the, you know, the UI that you get on a PlayStation.
The crossbar thing.
Yeah. Why that is, I think that they don't understand software.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the fundamental problem. Maybe they're learning now, but I think really Sony just doesn't get software the same way Apple gets software.
Right. So, like, downclock the CPU instead of making the software more efficient. Because that's what they know how to do.
I think probably the development was led by the hardware people.
Yeah.
And they would just lay down the rules for the software guys to try to chase and keep up with.
Right.
And what you end up with is like this kind of software stack that doesn't really work that well. Doesn't actually reflect the reality of the hardware because there's a lag between what the hardware design guys have done and what the software guys are doing. And I think that, you know, it's that old, is Apple a hardware or software company? I think they're a product company.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, you know, you can't, you know, like, just that's a great story because, you know, you can't just throw those pieces together at the end and think that they're going to work. And, you know, that's what's special and what's different about what Apple's doing. And people can try to emulate that. And I believe it can be emulated, but it's not going to be emulated overnight. Apple's been doing this for 30 years.
Yeah. I think you need to build a culture.
Yeah. And, and a culture and a process, you know, and a culture, a system of value, a series of values. Right. And so in one regard, you know, it goes back to what we said at the very beginning, Renee, about Samsung. I don't remember if the tape was running or not yet.
But we can recap.
Yeah, I mean, we can make fun of Samsung for copying Apple and everything, but you know, there's a lot of, I think the term I used was elbow grease. Like, there's a lot of elbow grease that goes into putting this stuff together and making it not explode. Mm-hmm. And Samsung is really, they've ramped up pretty quickly for a company that used to make DVD players and refrigerators. Like, they're a full blown hardware and software company now. And we can joke about how good it is or isn't, but they're getting things out the door. And I would actually argue, well, they're mimicking the Apple model, but for somebody like Google or Microsoft, you know, to work with OEMs, it's so hard to build a complete product like that when it's a committee, you know, when there's so many people involved. It's not just that it's a committee. There's like time zones, there's email tag, there's all this crap that goes away if it's all yours.
What's that old saying that it's a miracle that Windows boots, given the incredible amount of diversity in the hardware and how the software has to support it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I try to compliment, you know, I make fun of Windows all the time, but I also keep that in mind. Like, it's a miracle that this stuff works at all, considering all the moving parts and all the stakeholders. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's a nice uplifting way to think about it.
And I don't consider that to be a good thing, but you know, credit where credit's due, they managed to actually like get it out the door.
It's Herculean engineering.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you looking forward to? Because we were talking about iOS 7 before, and it seems like so much effort went into, you know, doing the maps and starting Passbook and doing some other stuff on iOS 6, that maybe iOS 7, they'll have more time or they'll at least have different things that they're working on. Is there something now as a developer that you want to see from iOS, or the things that they could do to make your life and the projects you're working on now easier?
I'd like to see them do more with networking. You know, that's just an area that Apple's never... You know, they have a, I don't want to say it's a low level, but it's a basic solution for, you know, networking and specifically communicating with web services.
Hey, do you remember that WS web services framework?
Which one?
2002, 2003 on the Mac, WS something.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
That, I remember that. And so that's
kind of awful.
I know. And so that's like the be careful what you wish for. You can make these jokes about maps and iCloud and Siri and all these cloud-based things that, you know, Apple's struggles with the internet.
Although, as you just said, regardless of what your opinion of them, those are Herculean efforts too. There's a lot of time and resources that went into them.
Yeah. You know, and they're trying, and, you know, to me, and that's not an excuse. It's, you know, you can't just say like they're trying, so it doesn't matter if it's not good. Of course it matters that it's good, but I'm encouraged by the fact that they acknowledge it's important. You know, the Apple of old would just, you know, laugh and say, we don't need to do that. But no, they acknowledge that it's significant to the future. So I'd like to see Apple take some more leadership in making it easier for us to consume web services. I mean, the popularity of AF networking, for example, is just a sign that what we get out of the box is not enough.
I found it encouraging when they added JSON support to Foundation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was probably driven by internal needs.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure.
A lot of stuff ends up trickling out that way. But, the iTunes search API is, you know, it's a web API. It returns a bunch of JSON. It's not bad. You know, there are signs that Apple's getting it, and at least better than they have been. So I'd really like to see that get better. And you know, I come at this from two ways, from two places. One is me as a developer getting my job done. The other is just as a consultant who cleans up messes quite a bit. It's the same stuff. You know, it's the same stuff over and over again. It's people not understanding how to do web services. It's people not understanding how to do core data. People not understanding how to manage memory, but that's now been taken care of.
Don't count your chickens.
Yeah, well,
I'm sure people were still screwed up, but yeah, it's true,
but it's a lot less than it used to be. Right. Arc was one. I joke about this, that Arc was a bittersweet thing for me because, yes, it's a huge weight off of my chest day to day, but I made a lot of money fixing other people's bad memory management. So that was a revenue source gone overnight.
You know what? I'm sure you're the same way. I try to write myself out of a job every single time.
Oh, totally. I mean, I say that, I'm joking when I say that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But I think that's I just wanted to be explicit about that, because I think that that's probably the best thing you should be trying to do as a programmer. And I think it leads to your success, is if you can try to get yourself out of the equation, you weirdly become more valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's a good positive feedback thing.
Yeah, there's two aspects to that. One is you've freed yourself up to do more interesting, more exciting things. Whether you're a contractor working hourly, a contractor working on fixed bid, or a full-time employee, you've demonstrated to management that you're not afraid of that. You know, that you're willing to do sort of what's best for the product, for the organization, whatever. There's always going to be things to do.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, I felt the same way, you know, we talked about what's new in iOS 6, you know, UI collection view. I would love to have had UI collection view 3 years ago. You know, I mean, I wrote a grid from scratch for one of my clients, and, you know, and then collection view came out and I was like, oh, you know, you could be angry about that, about wasted effort, or you could say, thank God, I don't have to maintain that code anymore. And, you want to be as optimistic as possible.
One of the things that reminded me, I wrote a bunch of text layout code that would like actually look at the TTF files and to get extra glyph information that wasn't available to you. I think it was iOS 2, 3, something like that. But basically kind of cloned what the NS text view sort of approach was onto iOS. And it took me a long time, and it was a lot of work and pretty tricky. And, you know, it's a text system. It's never 100% correct, but it got pretty good. And I think like the week I finished it, or the week I got it so that it was good enough that it could fit for the product I was building, was WWDC, and they announced Core Text was public. And I was like, oh my God. But I still don't regret it, because at least I learned how to do that kind of stuff.
So you guys had Craig and Sean on recently, right? Did you talk to, I didn't listen to the whole thing, but did you talk to Craig about his link finding code from like the original Twitterific on iOS before there was Cortex or any of that stuff?
Oh, you know what? I'm not sure if I did. I know I've half spoken to him about it, and I can't remember if it was actually on their podcast or not.
Yeah.
But go to regale us with the tale.
Well, I know I don't. All I remember is just his face when I asked him about it a couple of years ago. I hate that code, and I think I was asking a specific question, because I think it might have been like, oh, it might have been a while ago, because it was before Cortex. So I was going to pick his brain, and I said, you know, so what? And he's like, no, I'm not going to tell you how I did that, because I don't want that code getting out anywhere.
Oh man,
yeah. Like a disease. I mean, he said something like that. Like I don't want anybody else to do that.
Yeah, I think there was a bunch of problems with that. There was rendering it correctly, but also just detecting the URLs was failing. Because do you remember at one point Derek Fireball had that short link that was like the fireball symbol?
Yeah, the Unicode.
Yeah,
and it would totally screw up everybody's link detection stuff.
Oh, the tiny arrows. Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yep.
So I think poor Craig kept getting a lot of heat for that, but I think Gruber eventually just backed off.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I don't mean to, sorry, I may have outed Craig there about, you know, something he didn't want to talk about, but it's a great story. I mean, it's a great example of something where if it's not done for you, you got to start digging.
Right.
And you may or may not, you know, like what you find.
You always learn something now, which brings me to a question that I get asked every now and then, and you're probably in a better position to answer this. What is it like? What's a good way to get into, like, a good first book and a good way to get into sort of Mac or iOS development? Every time I get asked, I'm like, I don't know, 13 years ago, kind of thing. I can't remember. I don't know what I did. From your work with Apple, you must sort of have that must be a more common question that has come up for you.
Yeah, well, you know, and the answer was much different 4 years ago than it is now.
You're right, yeah.
Than it would be now. So, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people, and so I haven't attended or audited myself, but you know, a lot of people speak very highly of the Stanford class, which is still going on. Mm-hmm. It seems like a decent up-to-date survey of everything that's possible.
I think that's available on iTunes U.
It sure is.
Okay.
So, and there's a lot of stuff on iTunes U. You know, Brad Larson does, or at least did a class for a while, you know, with varying levels of skill. Sorry, I should say required skill level. His skill is very high. So iTunes U is a wonderful resource. I think the big issue is, are you already a programmer, or are you looking to program for the first time anywhere on iOS? Because that's a different conversation. And, you know, honestly, I wish I did. I don't really know a very good resource for iOS as your first platform.
Yeah.
I bet it's out there. And I know that, you know, there's a lot of online learning like the Khan Academy and Udemy. I know that they have some programming stuff. I have to think they're going to attack iOS at some point if they haven't already.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen any of the Khan Academy videos or anything like that?
They're excellent.
Yeah,
I really think what they're doing is awesome.
And yeah, that's like this, pretty revolutionary kind of stuff, I think.
Yeah, and especially now as a parent, you know, like it's that much more exciting to me. Yeah, I wish I had a good, you know, in terms of, you know, if you're already a programmer and you just want to get to know this platform, you know, I think the Stanford class is good. I think, you know, either book, just so I'm not appearing too partial, you know, Jeff LaMarche's book is pretty well maintained. You know, I believe it's called Beginning iPhone Development for APress. And of course, the Pragmatic Programmers, which is the company I wrote for, Bill Dudney and Chris Adamson have a nice book. Mm-hmm.
The Hillegas one too, just to
And Aaron's
just to
book.
Hit all the
Sorry, Aaron. I take Aaron's book for granted.
Well, it's the Bible in a lot of ways, you know.
Yeah, right.
You know what? That's interesting because I'm fascinated that you went to video because I had not really considered that, and I think that's telling about my, like, when I started learning this kind of stuff, that none of those kind of resources were available.
So for me, I use books as reference or in-depth, and, you know, reference. Like I will, and, you know, reference, you know, that sort of creates the illusion of somebody just flipping through pages and reading two at a time. But, you know, I mean, reference for in-depth knowledge, you know, I will always go to a video to see, just get high level points, which are hard to pick out of a book sometimes if the book's not perfectly, or I don't even want to say well-written, you know, it's just, it has to do with what the book's goal is. You know, a video is always a good video is always very instructive, in terms of orienting you, and that gives you better context to navigate a book with.
A great point. I hadn't really considered it before, but yeah, you can spend an hour watching the video and then you can go away and spend whatever the 8 to 12 hours that it takes you cumulatively to sort of get to the book.
And I think you mentioned Apple's documentation, and I think this is what Apple does well. They do these high level guides, which you read the guide, you're not ready to ship an app yet, but you know where to look now. And, you know, even a step higher than that, you know, when I haven't watched that many videos from WWDC 12, but I have looked at a lot of slide decks.
Really?
They have the PDF slides, and you look at the title and you say, okay, I think this is what I'm looking for. You look at the slides. No, this is not the right talk. And then you go to the next one, you go through the slides. I think this is it. Yeah, that looks good. Oh yes, this is exactly what I'm looking for. Now I'm going to watch the video. You just have all these tools available to you, so you can just sort of, it's a drill down, you know?
Right. Yeah, that WWDC thing got really slick over the past couple of years.
It has.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I personally, I love that all the videos go up the week after, 2 weeks after, whatever it is, despite having paid to go. I don't care. I'm not losing.
You don't go for this. I mean, I need to be very careful here because WWDC used to be my baby, and I know how hard people work on it. But you obviously, the sessions are important, but the labs are incredibly valuable. Yeah. And that's a huge reason to go as opposed to just stay home and watch videos. The camaraderie is very important.
Well, so here's the thing. I mean, the videos are great, but you don't get to see the person presenting, which I find is, for some reason, it helps me connect with the, it's easier to understand stuff when there's somebody walking around on stage. Yeah, exactly. But you're not sitting next to somebody at home when you're watching the thing. And that kind of, like, there's a big group of people around, and that's got a lot of value, just being with like-minded people interested in the same kind of thing.
Right. And that's a conference versus a, that's the sign of a good conference.
Yeah, exactly. And it works pretty well. Yeah.
Well, and for me, I work at home. So I mean, I'm sitting here in my little office in the back of the house right now. I can't sit through a full dub video in my house. Something happens, phone rings, the dog barks at the mailman, you know, whatever it is. Yeah.
You have another child.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, when you're at that conference, you're probably going to stay in the room.
Right.
You know, unless you're in the wrong room, you're going to pay attention. And that's, you know, if you really want that, if you want to really get that knowledge, yeah, you do need to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that the videos are available is awesome. I mean, you know, for me, having, you know, gone back to when they were months late and not free, yeah, what an improvement. And I think Apple's understood that this is not lock and key stuff. Like the knowledge and making it easier for more developers to do good work, you know, increases the quality bar, raises the quality bar, and increases the developer audience, which are both things for Apple.
It's been a long, fun trip since back in 2001 kind of thing. I think Apple's changed a lot in the way that it not approaches developers, but they've dropped some of the secrecy. They've really sort of, I don't know. It feels like they've grown up a bit.
They better understand the value developers can bring to their platform.
Absolutely. No, I absolutely think that. I don't think that view necessarily has changed. I think there were certain places that always saw that, but at a higher level, you know, at a higher executive level, strategically, you know, as a strategic importance to the company, I think that they value that now. And I know I said that at C4, you know, I think I opened up with, you know, these ads, which really structurally, these ads have not changed in 5 years.
Right.
Like it's the device with third-party apps running on it. It's like, it's totally, it's not unprecedented anymore, but in 2009, it was completely unprecedented for Apple to just be putting its own brand on the line and its own image in the hands of people other than Apple.
To use third parties to sell their hardware.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, no, that was crazy. Yeah.
And it's still, you know, it's still like, you know, these iPad apps is just third party apps running on the iPad. You're absolutely right. The dynamic has changed for the better, in my opinion.